Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann today. The White House Office of Communications is one of the key aspects to any successful presidency. The office can drive and define the president's agenda, strategic plan, and overall image. Presidential communication has changed slowly over the years. We went from fireside chats on the radio to televised press conferences to the web and social media, but it's always been relatively stable and predictable. Well, the last 6 months, presidential communications has been far from predictable. It's been chaotic with mixed messages, different messages. It's been filled with leaks and the need to walk back the president's comments. This hour, we talk about what makes effective White House communications, and we'll assess what's going on with the Trump White House. And joining me by phone right now is the director of the White House Transition Project and a retired political science professor at Towson University, Martha Joynt Kumar. She is the author of several books on the presidency, including Managing the President's Message, the White House Communications Operations. Martha, welcome to All Sides on 89.7.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Well, let's start with the basic bottom line question. You've studied White House communications. How would you assess the communication strategy of the Trump White House?
I think that presidential communications really follow the president, that he sets the tone in the White House and others follow. And it's a White House tends to reflect a president and not really fill in for his weaknesses. They show his strength. In his case, he feels that he is the communications director. And if you look at the turnover in that particular office, even before he came into office, he named Jason Miller to the communications post, and then he stepped aside a couple of days later and said, well, Sean Spicer was going to take it over. So then Spicer had both the job of press secretary and communications director, which does not work out well because the jobs really are different. And then Mike Dubke came in, and then he was pushed out, and then Spicer took over the job again for the second time, and then Scaramucci came in, then he left, and now it's vacant.
Yeah.
So I think it is just reflective of what the communications have been like in this White House. It all depends on the president, and it can be all of their communications plans, like American Heroes Week can be blown up by tweets that he has 1 week after another.
Yeah.
His staff has tried to put together weeks of a consistent policy line.
One of the misconceptions is that the press secretary that we see every day in the White House briefing is in charge of communications at the White House, but that's not the case usually.
No, it isn't. when the post of press secretary first developed in 1929, that person did everything. But today, you know, the demands are much different. So in 1969, the Office of Communications was created by President Nixon, and that was to do long-range planning because the press secretary is working on the day-to-day, answering reporters' questions, trying to get out the message the president wants, be a facilitator between reporters and the White House staff. Those are the kinds of things that a press secretary does, and it's very day-to-day operation. The communications operation, on the other hand, is really taking the long-range view and trying to do planning, and that is particularly difficult. Both have been difficult, actually, the press secretary's job and the communications job, because they've been made more difficult by the president's inconsistent positions and statements that often are at odds with what the White House has said that it's wanted to do.
Now, presidents have often, you know, they don't always see eye to eye with their communications director. But how What is the norm in a president deferring to the communications director, the communications professionals? You know, they've made their careers. I mean, this is the top of their career, usually. If you're the communications director, the chief spokesperson for the president of the United States, you are presumably very well accomplished in your field. You've got a lot of experience. How easy has it been for past presidents to defer to that expertise?
I think it's always difficult because the president is the elected official, and that is what communications directors know. They know what it is the president wants to accomplish, what the long-range strategy is, and his interests and goals and how he wants to get there. And President Trump's case, he has spent more time than most presidents do looking backward, looking back at his election, and talking about that, talking about the Clintons, now talking about Comey, rather than looking forward to what he wants to do. Often it's about people who he feels have crossed him in some ways. Now, if you look at President Bush, when he came in, also with a minority of popular vote,
George W.
What
Bush,
he did, yes, when he came in, what he did was he did not talk about the election. Rather, he looked forward. He had a plan for each week in the first months of his presidency. So the first week was Education Week. He introduced legislation on education, had his Secretary of Education, Rod Paige, out talking about the No Child Left Behind initiative. And then they moved on to faith-based initiatives the next week, and then increasing defense spending, tax cuts. So it was always a positive agenda. He assumed he won the electoral votes. He was president. And what was he going to do as president?
Well, the Trump administration has tried to do that. They have, you know, we've had Energy Week. Believe it or not, this week is American Dream Week. Very few people know that, but it's American Dream Week, but it's been filled with. Now, there was a major piece of legislation that the Trump administration argues will help the American dream, help people reach the American dream, and that's his immigration policy. Others disagree with that, but that is the major piece of policy that came out with this strategy of the American Dream Week. But also what came out this week is, you know, his inaccurate statements about talking with the head of the Boy Scouts, who Trump claimed that his speech was the best ever given to the Boy Scouts, and which was not true. And and then we had this morning, he's talking about how relationship with Russia is at an all-time low. Folks who lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis might disagree with that. It seems like it's more of a discipline problem from the president's perspective that is undermining his communications office efforts.
Absolutely, it is. Yeah. And then, but that too, in American Heroes Week, John McCain came back, gave a speech and about the dysfunction in Washington. And then when they voted on health care, he took the position against the Republican proposal, and so he became the hero, unwittingly, of American Heroes Week. It's been very very difficult to discipline him because if you think about it, he's never held a public office before. He's run a company where he controlled timing, he controlled all the various elements of decision making. And here he comes into a situation that's very different. He has to share power with Congress. Congress appropriates the money.
And he's never really been fact-checked before. In fact, in his book, he writes that, you know, a little exaggeration can help you in business. But, you know, a little exaggeration or a lot of exaggeration in politics comes back to bite you.
It does because it is going to affect his credibility and the degree to which people feel that he's honest. And those numbers have been falling. And you need your credibility as president because you're going to be asking people to do things, sometimes to give up for something for a greater good. And if you don't have credibility, it's very difficult to make persuasive arguments.
And that goes to the bigger picture of this. This is compelling theater, and the media, you know, just jumps on all of these things all of the time. Every tweet is breaking news, but there are real implications for the administration and for the United States government, and it is that credibility issue you mentioned.
Yes. And one of the things that I've noticed in looking at his public appearances is when you look at the last six presidents and the number of addresses and remarks each has given, going from the inaugural address to the State of the Union message to the very small things that are done each day, that he has given many fewer than did George W. Bush or did Barack Obama. And that has meant that his tweets become that much more important. In the first 6 months, he had 1,033 tweets. And with the millions of people following him and the time that he does it, he does it at the beginning of the day so that he can establish the narrative for the day. And that makes it all the more damaging when they have a particular week, like Energy Week, and he's talking about crooked Hillary and why isn't she investigated. But it is also damaging, I think, of having fewer remarks. But he had 196, Barack Obama had 283, and George W. Bush had 297. Clinton had 242.
These are appearances in front of public appearances where he made speeches.
They're public, they're public addresses and remarks. And so in those, you tell where you're going, what it is you want to do. And in his case, because he's not held elective office, that means he's not had to cast a vote on anything where people know what his position was. Mm-hmm. So he comes in as somebody who people know very little about, and he has spent much of his time, you could say, twittering it away.
Yeah.
And not talking about substantive things.
He mentioned that the media hates the fact that he tweets, and I would disagree with that. I think the media loves the fact that
they love it. Yeah.
Because first, it's always a story. Usually, perhaps the media makes it into too big of a story, but it also gives you a window into what the president is thinking at that time. Now, usually, you have to wait decades. I mean, I'm thinking about Lyndon Johnson. We had to wait decades for those tapes to come out. Imagine if Lyndon Johnson had access to Twitter. I mean, he would say some outlandish things that we found out later, wheeling and dealing. And really, it was up to historians to uncover that years later. But we're seeing it in real time. Is there a good side to that?
Well, you get to know the president, that's for sure. You know what is on his mind. I mean, if you look at the take that Lyndon Johnson made, that what you see is the president trying to get things done. He talked about why the presidency was important. For example, he was talking to aides right shortly after he became president, and they were telling him that he'd be sacrificing a lot if he would start out on civil rights legislation because it was such an explosive issue. And so he said that he was going to do civil rights legislation. And he said, what is the presidency for? And so that was something that was always in his mind as to what he was going to do with his presidency. And I don't think that that's something in Donald Trump's mind.
Although we got a bit of a hint of that. I know you may not have heard it because you are on vacation this week, but the Washington Post published transcripts today of conversations with the president of Mexico. And he admitted that, the wall is not high on his priority list as far as immigration and other things go. And that's a political reality. Many feel the wall was just campaign hyperbole. And that's something that was released in real time. That wasn't a tweet. That was a leak. But that's the whole other thing.
Well, I thought the story there is the fact that a conversation between the president and a foreign leader was leaked, is that is something that's just not done. And it shows the degree to which there is division within the administration and within the White House, that people are leaking that kind of information. That really is information that should be held close.
It is a totally new reality with communications at the White House. Martha Joynt Kumar is the director of the White House Transition Project and a retired political science professor at Towson University. Martha, thanks very much for joining us here on All Sides.
Thank you. My pleasure.
When we come back, we'll talk with two political communications pros and get their thoughts on what's going on at the current White House and get their thoughts on what makes effective, successful political communication. When All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We're talking about presidential communications, political communications. You know, the White House Communications Office is always a very dramatic place. It is the window for the public to see what's going on at the White House, what the president's agenda is, what the president's message is. It's been dramatized in TV show after TV show. Just think West Wing and House of Cards. But the Trump administration has provided a little more drama than usual in the White House Communications Office, and we're here talking about that today on All Sides. Joining us is a former speechwriter to President Obama, Stephen Crouppen. Stephen, welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
You are now the Senior Vice President and Director of Executive Communications at SKD Knickerbocker, a public affairs and political consulting firm that specializes in working with Democrats. Also joining us, Clark Judge, former speechwriter in the Reagan White House and founder and managing director of the White House Writers Group, a strategic communications consultancy in Washington. Clark, welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Good to be with you.
Thank you both. You bring tremendous experience and know-how into this presidential communication issues. Clark, we'll start with you. You know, when Anthony Scaramucci came in, he said that the White House basically had a communications problem. How much of the problem at the White House is a communications problem, and how much of it is a governing problem?
Well, it's really more communications than governing, but it's the situation in Washington is very challenging right now. The president did not have the kind of honeymoon most presidents do. The opposition party was resolved to paralyze his presidency from the first. That's a big challenge. At the same time, the media was deeply hostile, as we saw as recently as yesterday during the press conference with Stephen Miller. So this was a big difference from past administrations. Now, some of that, there were a lot of reasons for that. Did the people criticize the president's tweets? And some of the president's tweets are easily criticized. But we're in a very different media environment than was the norm, not only recently, but also in the more general past. For example, when the technology, in particular, of communications has changed dramatically, and that's changed the dynamic. The Obama administration faced some of this and responded to it. They started putting out, keeping photographers out of some events and having the White House photographer cover them. The use of Twitter has been criticized, of course, but it's also given the president a tool for breaking up the rhythm of the day and keeping the White House story in. So it's a mix, But what I'm basically saying is that this is a new environment, a very challenging environment, and the White House is responding accordingly.
Stephen Crouppen, you could argue that if Hillary Clinton had been elected, the opposition party would have been just as tough on her as Democrats have been on Trump. Whether the media would have been as tough on her, I don't know. I think you can argue that it has been tougher on Trump for whatever reason. We can get into that in a moment. But Stephen Crouppen, you worked with President Obama and you work now with Democrats. What do you see as the reason for what appears to be instability, chaos in the White House? Is it a communications issue or is it a governing issue?
Well, it's certainly a communications problem, as Clark said, but it is also a policy problem. It is also a president problem. And let me just say, we don't have to assume a hypothetical about whether the opposition would have stood in President Hillary Clinton's way, because that's exactly what they did with President Obama. As Clark said, the opposition resolved to paralyze from the first. That's what we saw with Mitch McConnell saying that their number one objective was to make President Obama one-term president. But that didn't lead to anywhere near the kinds of communications problems in an Obama White House that we're seeing in the Trump White House. And I think one of the reasons is that communications is about coordination and it's about credibility. This White House has neither. It's about coordination because all the agencies need to be on the same page. The president and his staff, his communications department, certainly need to be on the same page. And we're not seeing that here. We're not seeing the White House and, for example, the Department of Justice on the same page talking about policy, talking about message and consistent themes. We're certainly seeing the president set up his communications staff with really difficult jobs. For example, when he tweets, when he makes claims that are false, that are demonstrably false, that his spokespeople then have to go out and defend, that kind of coordination undercuts whatever message they're proactively trying to convey. And secondly, it's about credibility. When the president says things like he did just in the last few days, that he had a conversation with the president of Mexico that didn't happen, that he had a conversation with the head of the Boy Scouts that didn't happen, that undermines the credibility of the people who have to speak on his behalf.
We're talking about presidential communication with two folks from both sides of the aisle. One works with Democrats, one works with Republicans here on all sides with Ann Fisher. Let's step back a bit, and we can use examples from the Trump administration. Let's look at, you know, how this is supposed to work and what the best practices are. Stephen Crouppen, who worked with President Obama, what is the bottom line rule in presidential communications?
The bottom line rule in presidential communications is to tell the truth. That's the number one thing. As Mark Twain said, if you tell the truth, you don't have to remember anything. It also makes it a lot easier to be consistent in your messaging. That's why I say that communications requires credibility, and that's something that this administration never had because the candidate, President Trump as a candidate, didn't have it. And he carried that over into this term. So one is it's about being honest. It's about telling the truth. And secondly, again, it's about coordination. It's about making sure that you are proactively conveying a message and not undercutting your own control of the news cycle. We see right now, even this morning with the president's tweets, how whatever message they're trying to drive is undercut by the principal. And that makes it really difficult for everyone else in the organization, in the White House and across the agencies, to do their job and execute and not be distracted. That's why every time there's a press briefing in the White House briefing room, and Clark was talking about not having cameras rolling in the White House, that's what's happening now is a big case study in how to do it wrong and how to undermine credibility.
Clark Judge, Clark, let's get Clark Judge in here. Clark, I mean, the U.S. government is huge. I mean, the president of the United States sits on top of this immense organization. How does the White House Communications Office try to maintain consistency and message discipline? What are some of the tools that the White House communication folks will use?
Well, in the past, tools have included things such as message of the day, guidance that goes out to agencies, guidance that's used in the daily briefing, a variety of coordination of presidential statements, and with other forms being put out. Now, it is true that this White House has not been doing that sort of thing nearly so much as past White Houses. This White House is more driven by the the day-to-day statements of the president, generally less coordinated than they have been in the past. That, to some extent, has to do with changes in technology. It has to do with the unusual hostility, which is unusual, much more than President Obama faced in the media, which was very pro-President Obama, and is very anti-President Trump. So we see all of this as, I'd say all of this is both a question of different styles, but also changes in technology and a change in the environment in Washington.
Clark, just looking at this morning's tweets from Donald Trump, his first tweet, these were all sent out almost simultaneously about 2 hours ago, about 9:30 Eastern. He writes, his first one is business looking better than ever, with business enthusiasm at record levels, stock market at an all-time high. That doesn't just happen! Exclamation point. Next tweet, I am continuing to get rid of costly and unnecessary regulations. Much work left to do, but the effect will be great. Business and jobs will grow. Two pretty standard messages for an incumbent or a sitting president.
Right.
But then he goes on to say, our relationship with Russia is at an all-time and very dangerous low. So that trumps the other two. If he had just stopped at the first two, talking about the stock market, which is at an all-time high, and his efforts to get rid of regulations, those tweets would have been perhaps more effective than they were, because they're overshadowed by what is probably a false claim that we're at an all-time low in our relationship with Russia.
Well, in both of those, you're asking me, right?
Yes, Clark, yep.
In both of those, he's tracking the news of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trying to put the White House, his view, use his view to drive the coverage, which, by the way, we're driving it now in part by repeating it.
Yes.
And that's happening all through the news sphere. Would it be better to focus just on the economics? Well, maybe, but clearly this is a White House that does many things at once. We might say that established practice in the past is different, and that's true. But the established practice, for example, when Reagan was in the White House, and really up until quite a bit later, involved an environment which had a limited number of television channels, a limited number of radio and news outlets. Now we're dealing with a much different kind of environment. The Obama administration, as I said, started to respond to it, did it fairly well. The Trump administration is doing it differently. He may be taking criticism from all sorts of sources that are more used to the past ways. But remember, this was also how he got elected.
Yep.
And there's something changing as a result of the net. And he has, in my view, more effectively, as well as with a lot of problems along the way, no doubt about that.
Stephen Krupin, you worked with President Obama, speech writer with him. So you were exposed to the Twitter age was just getting going during the Obama presidency. Were there any rules as far as use of Twitter, and did President Obama have rules on his use of Twitter? Maybe he just didn't like it. Of course, it was still in a relative infancy when he started his presidency. But what was the role of Twitter in the Obama White House, from your perspective?
President Obama did like Twitter, and he used it very well. And the reason that he used it well was that it was consistent with the message being driven throughout the White House and throughout the administration.
Did he write his own tweets?
He wrote his own tweets. Sometimes you would see them signed with his initials at the end when they were his own. But any tweet that went out from the POTUS account, he did see ahead of time and approve personally. We know that Donald Trump, President Trump, is approving his tweets personally because he's clearly writing them himself. And the way we know that he's writing them himself is they're totally detached often, as you just read out, from the objectives of the communications operation on any given day. There's a right way to use Twitter, and there's a destructive way to use Twitter. And it is a great way to reach people directly. It is a great way to personalize the policies that you're talking about. there is a wrong way to do it, which is, as you're saying, talking about things that are completely off topic and sometimes saying things that are demonstrably false, that distracts the audience and that detracts attention from what you're trying to accomplish.
We're talking about presidential communications and how the operation works in theory and how it's working now with the current President Donald Trump. Our guest, Stephen Krupin, he's Senior Vice President and Director of Communications at SKD Knickerbocker and a former speechwriter for President Obama. And also Clark Judge is the founder and managing director of the White House Writers Group and former speechwriter in the Reagan White House. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Clark, again, trying to step back from, you know, it's hard to step back from what's going on in the White House, but how, when a president says something that's, you know, perhaps wrong or it's a gaffe or it's a mistake, and the communication staff has to sort of walk it back, is the term that we're overusing these days. How do you do that? What is the political strategy there, the communication strategy there?
Well, before we get into that, let me just make a small dissent from what we just heard in this sense, and it's not a partisan one. It's more a technical one. I don't view Twitter as important for reaching people directly. It is important in that way, but that's not its primary tool. Reaching the public directly. Its primary force as a tool is driving media coverage.
Yeah, only 15% of the public is on Twitter, by the way. The hype is much more than the actual use, but you're right.
It's much more important as a vehicle for driving media coverage. And so when you see the president take on two different areas at once, what he's doing really is inserting his views into the coverage of media. Now, everybody who talks about Russia on the various cable channels and in the media is going to be referencing the president's tweet on that. Everybody who's doing the same with the economy is going to be referencing the president's tweet. He's inserted himself into stories, and that's what that's the real use of Twitter. In this time, it is not a way of getting yourself in front of the 14 million people or whatever it is that he has on his feed. It's getting himself in front of the media and changing the media, or at least shaping the media coverage of particular stories.
All right, well, let's take a break, and we'll come back, and we'll talk about some other things that seem to be going on more and more at the Trump White House. One is leaks. And how they occur and how they're dealt with. That's when All Sides continues with on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We are talking about presidential communications, political communications, how it affects policy, how it can guide policy and public support for an administration's agenda. We're talking with two political pros from Washington, D.C. Stephen Krupin was a former senior speechwriter for President Obama, and Clark Judge, a former speechwriter in the Reagan White House. If you'd like to join the conversation, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Clark, I'm going to ask you a question about how communication strategy can make up for a failure. Let me use the example of that's in the theaters right now, and that's Dunkirk. Dunkirk was, of course, the evacuation of hundreds of thousands of troops from the beach in France during World War II. That was made necessary because of a pretty colossal military failure. The Allies totally misjudged what the German army was going to do. They were surrounded. They were pushed onto the beach and nearly obliterated. But the narrative became what a heroic, with justification, what a heroic move it was to evacuate these folks from the beach. So that's an example of how you can take lemons and make lemonade, to use the cliche. How can a good communication strategy make up for a policy failure or a governing failure?
Well, in Dunkirk, what Churchill did was focus on the future rather than the past, and focus on the heroism of the British in a time of trial. And those two became his theme all through the Second World War. They very much built on a kind of established theme in British foreign policy and foreign circles that went back to the Boer Wars and even earlier, of early defeats followed by later victories, powered by the courage of British soldiers. You see that occurring over and over and over again, Napoleonic Wars even earlier.
Washington crossing the Delaware, he was retreating.
Washington crossing the Delaware was actually advancing. He had been in winter quarters. They crossed the Delaware and did a surprise attack on the Hessians at Trenton. But mm-hmm. remember also that, just since you brought that up, that was the real part of that was that if Washington had not crossed the Delaware and begun an offensive, he had most of his army. He was down to like 10% of the army he had a few months earlier, and the other 10, the rest of them were all their obligations were up on New Year's Day. So he needed to give them a victory to hold them, yeah. just to hold his army together. That's an example of focusing on the future.
So that's the key,
though. And focusing on hope.
So let me ask you this, then. By Donald Trump's administration constantly going back to Hillary Clinton in the election, that goes against what the standard communication policy should be or practice should be.
Well, except that I would say that most administrations, President Obama was a big example of this. Go back to how things were so bad in the past, and in this case, also how bad the alternative was. Mm-hmm. And then they build their view of the future. So this is not unusual, what he's doing in that sense.
Stephen Krupin, your thoughts on this, how communications can soften what can be a difficult policy decision or a policy failure?
I agree. Certainly it starts with having the credibility to control what that message is. And the example of Dunkirk that you gave, what it really represented was the spirit of unity, the spirit of national unity that, as you said, made some lemonade out of this lemon situation. It also led, of course, to one of the great speeches that people like Clark and I and other speechwriters always think about of how to rally a nation, and that is it led to Churchill's Fight Them on the Beaches speech. So that's an important way to determine what is going to be the message, what is going to be that spirit that leads you into the future. As far as whether you're distracting your audience by talking about the past administration, certainly in President Obama's case, the argument about where we came from was essential to providing the context for how far we've come, coming out of the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. That is very different than Donald Trump saying, don't look over here, and let's investigate my political opponent, and let's sic my Justice Department and special counsel and attorney general after my political opponent, which is antithetical to everything that we know about how a democracy and free elections work.
Let's talk about leaks. There have been a lot of leaks out of the Trump White House, but leaks that are nothing new. And there are good leaks and there are bad leaks. Stephen Krupin, explain what a good leak is and what a bad leak is. A good leak could also be called a plant, I guess.
It's a way that any administration works with the press to, again, to drive the message. What is happening in this administration is slightly different, and that is staffers undermining the boss, undermining the message and the policy agenda of the administration. So one way that is really an enlightening way to think about this, let me quote one of my former colleagues, Kristen Bartolone, who was a deputy research director in the White House, which means among other things, her job was to fact-check everything that the speechwriters and the communicators presented to the president and pushed out publicly. So fact-checking, as quaint as that might sound in 2017 in the Trump administration, one thing that Kristen said recently was, what helps prevent leaks is being the kind of boss that staffers like and respect. And so I think when we talk about the leaks, we have to see it as a symptom of a very dysfunctional White House, a very dysfunctional administration. We had a group of people in the Obama White House that would not have done this, would not have leaked damaging or disrespectful information that would make the administration look bad in the way that we see is happening today.
But the Obama administration was very aggressive in trying to stop leaks, prosecuting leakers, and really was more than just a carrot. He was waving a stick around to try to prevent leaks, correct?
That, I think we're talking about slightly different things. When we're talking about the leaks that we see in this administration, it is information like the transcripts that came out this morning of President Trump speaking to foreign leaders from Mexico and Australia. Those are internal documents, internal national security transcripts that are leaked really to undermine President Trump. And that is a very different and new ground that we're seeing today.
Well, Edward Snowden, all of his information, those are pretty incredible leaks as well. Not to the, at all. They all came out basically at once, but that came out during the Obama administration as well. So, Clark, how do you deal with leaks? How do you stop leaks? First of all, can you stop leaks? What's the strategy there?
Well, let me just go to the unusual character of the leaks that we're seeing now and the reason for them. A big part of the reason is that there are a lot of Obama holdovers who have taken the view in junior positions, who have taken the view the resistance that we're hearing through from the Democrats in Congress and have been leaking. There are also people who are apparently in the intelligence community who have taken the same view. This is unusual. Some of this is because the White House hasn't staffed up as fast as it should, and that's a problem. But it's also a case that there are a lot of positions in the government that would normally be held by political appointees, and while the appointment process went slow at first, it's been going very rapidly, but the approval process, the confirmation process has not, which also makes the administration vulnerable to these kinds of leaks from people who are basically not on board with it in any way.
Well, aren't some of the leaks coming from, because it's more than just the Democrats that are resisting, it's perhaps establishment Republicans that are resisting, who are not big fans of Donald Trump.
But what I'm saying is that you've got a lot of people who are neither who are not establishment Republicans or Trump Republicans who are still in positions and have taken it upon themselves to leak. The administration needs to staff up. That is clearly one of the biggest challenges of this administration, and a place where, whether it's because of confirmations or because of getting people in place, through a process that seems to go on certain levels a little slower than in the past, it's got a real problem with not having people on board who are in sync with the president's program.
We're talking about communication strategy, the nature of presidential communications, how it can drive and even undermine an administration's agenda. Clark, let's talk about the media's role in all this. I mean, you've talked a bit about how the media has been very aggressive with Donald Trump, and it has. I will hope that the media is as aggressive with Trump's successor, whoever he or she may be, and whatever party they belong to. I think it's good for the democracy to have an aggressive press. A couple things: that every tweet is breaking news on the cable nets. We're carrying the presidential briefings live every single day. How much of this hysteria over communications and attention to every utterance from the president is the media's fault? Clark.
Well, one of the themes I've been pursuing in this is that technology has changed. And it began changing really almost about the time Reagan left office, when I was there. When we started seeing cable channels come on, and then later we were having speeches that were covered live in presidential campaigns all the way through that would have been maybe got a soundbite before on the evening news. Then we moved to social media and to Twitter but other forms of social media as well. All of this has changed things dramatically in the White House and changed, therefore, dramatically the way in which the White House responds to the working press and to the to communications. There are a lot of reasons for saying that the Trump administration is not doing well in communications, but there are also some reasons that go unnoticed for saying that there may be more method to this madness than normally thought. If you look, yes, he's low in the polls. On the other hand, President Obama dropped dramatically in the polls in his first term. He started from a higher point. So he didn't fall to quite this level, but it's not that much below this level.
Mm-hmm.
That may be a pattern that's more with the presidency in our period than otherwise.
Stephen Krupe, let me get your take on this. We just have a few minutes left, and I want to get one final question to both of you before we wrap up here. But is the media partly to blame for the hysteria surrounding the early months of the Trump administration?
I think if the Trump administration is looking for someone to blame, they need only look in the mirror. But first, Mike, I just want to take issue with one thing that Clark said that I think is really important to clarify about your last question about leaks. There is no such thing as an Obama holdover in the Trump administration who is trying to undermine the president as part of the resistance, as Clark claims. The last of the Obama political appointees left, as I did, in January 2017. The people we're talking about are civil servants who are nonpartisan, who work under Republicans and Democrats, who might have been working in the Bush administration and then the Obama administration, now the Trump administration, and would stay on perhaps in the next administration regardless of which party. So it's really important not to impugn the integrity of the public servants who are in the administration right now.
I got one last question with just a couple minutes left here. The White House press corps, Sean Spicer in particular, I mean, not the press corps, but the press office, Sean Spicer in particular, has been criticized for not standing up to the president. For instance, the famous briefing after the inauguration where he claimed it was the largest crowd or to ever witness an inauguration, both in person and online. How would you handle a president, Stephen Krupe, how would you handle a president that likes to freewheel? What advice would you give to him?
Well, to a president who likes to freewheel, they are the boss. And as Clark and I know, having been fortunate enough to work in these positions, we serve as advisors. No one elected us into any office. But again, going back to what we said a few minutes ago, the number one rule of communications is to tell the truth. And a staffer has absolutely no obligation to lie on behalf of a president who is not telling the truth or to defend a lie as the president's spokespeople are required to do now from the podium and elsewhere. If somebody finds themselves in that position, there is no reason why they can't leave that job. There is no reason why anyone has to work for somebody who they don't believe in.
Clark, how hard is it to do that? Here you are. Like I said before, you've reached the pinnacle of your career if you're in this position, and you are supposed to do the president's – carry his message. How do you handle that?
Before I answer that, let me just make one correction to what Steve said. A number of political people get themselves careered in. They want to have an ongoing career in the government, and then they become part of the career staff. This administration has been slow in replacing not just careered in people, but also political
people. But quickly,
people.
Clark, would you get out and say that there was the largest inauguration crowd ever, period?
Well, Spicer made a mistake with that, but on the other hand, he was right in that the global audience was larger.
Well, it's, yeah. That also is up for debate. As we have heard during this hour, there's lots of things to debate, and the debate will continue. But I do appreciate Stephen Krupin and Clark Judge. Stephen Krupin, former speechwriter with President Obama. Clark Judge, a former speechwriter with President Reagan. Give us some insight into how presidential communications works, how it's supposed to work, and the challenges they face in this new media world. Thanks very much to you both. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.